I have the pleasure of introducing our second speaker, John Hansen from the U.S. General Accounting Office. He joined the GAO in 1974 and is currently the assistant director with the healthcare team. He is responsible for directing studies and evaluations on several topics, including Medicare and Medicaid prescription drug benefits, the pharmaceutical industry, prescription drug pricing and utilization. Currently, he has directed studies on adding a prescription drug benefit to Medicare, drug company patient assistance programs, and state pharmacy assistance programs. Mr. Hansen has spoken with state legislatures in California, Maine, New Hampshire, New York, Rhode Island, and Vermont. Personally, Mr. Hansen has coached a traveling soccer team, and for the last 5 years, he has organized WAGS, the Washington Area Girls Soccer Tournament, which encompasses 400 teams. So expect he'll be kicking around some ideas today with you during the question and answer sessions, and then later in the discussion session. His topic today, the experience of 14 states providing drug benefits in 1999. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you very much, Jessica. I'm really pleased to be here today to share with you the results of a report that GAO issued last September on state pharmacy assistance programs in 14 states. Steve Schonemeyer later will talk about some of the newer efforts that are ongoing in some of the other states. I brought along a copy. This is what the report looks like. You can get it off the internet, and I believe that information is in the handouts. It just doesn't have the pretty GAO blue cover that we're well known for on it. See if I have a little more success with this here. Well, I guess not, Meg.
I'm glad it wasn't just me.
Okay. First of all, let me just say a little bit about who GAO is for those of you who don't know us. GAO is Congress's investigative arm. In that regard, we support the Congress in meeting its responsibilities for improving the performance and accountability of federal government for the American people. We examine the public use of funds and we evaluate federal programs, and we provide Congress with objective, fact-based, nonpartisan analyses, options, recommendations, and other assistance to help the Congress in making effective oversight, policy, and funding decisions. What I want to talk about today is I want to provide you a little background on the study that we did, talk about study objectives, its scope and methodology, eligibility requirements, benefit design features, program funding sources, and programming administration. Again, we're focusing here on 14 states that had 18 programs in 1999. Steve will give a little bit of a more detail about some of the newer programs that are coming on. The objectives of our study were to assist Congress. In this case, it was the House Committee on Commerce, which is now called the House Committee on Energy and Commerce. They're one of the key players in terms of adding a drug benefit to Medicare. We did a series of studies for them looking at various aspects of this issue, and this was one of the areas that they were particularly concerned about. The reason that they were concerned about this is because Medicare doesn't pay for prescription drugs. And as I think those of you who attended previous seminars said that about two-thirds of the Medicare participants have coverage through various sources. Some of them have it through employer-sponsored plans, Medicare Plus Choice plans, some through Medicare supplement policies, and some through Medicaid. Yet about one-third of the Medicare beneficiaries must pay for their drugs out of pocket. And Medicare beneficiaries are particularly vulnerable to costs due to their high rate of utilization of prescription drugs. Next slide. Again, the purpose here was to help Congress evaluate proposals for extending prescription drug coverage to Medicare by examining state prescription drug assistance programs for the elderly and those with low incomes. There were two key factors we were looking at here. One was to try and identify the characteristics of state programs that are designed to provide these benefits to these eligible populations. And the second was to examine the administrative and policy issues that the states encountered in operating their programs. Next slide. To do this, we looked at 14 states that operated 18 programs in 1999. With each of the states, we conducted structured interviews with state program officials to gather information on the policies, design features, operations of each state program. We also reviewed relevant laws, regulations, program literature, and interviewed senior citizen advocates. Next slide. This might be very hard for you to see. I apologize for that. It is in both the report and I believe in the handout, which should be a little bit clearer for you. Page 22 of the booklet. The state eligibility requirements vary quite a bit from state to state. States use age, income, and other criteria to try and target and control the program size. And this is one of the key findings we had from our study, is one of the things that states have to wrestle with is how large of a program do we want to have, how large can we afford in our state budget. And eligibility criteria are a key element for trying to do that. In 1999, the income limits ranged from anywhere from 100 to 225% of the federal poverty level. You can see that's in the second column from the left. These provide actually quite a wide range in the income levels for people who are individuals or married and household limits. Three states, Minnesota, Maryland, and Wyoming, also have asset limits. That's rather unique in here. Typically, we only found states using income as a criteria here. 12 of the 18 programs also allowed some people with disabilities to be eligible, but the age requirements for people with disabilities varied from state to state. Another key aspect of this is that most states allow people with other drug coverage to enroll in their program. You might recall earlier I said, well, two-thirds of the Medicare population has some sort of prescription drug coverage. The problem is that for some of those people, the coverage is not very good. In many of those areas, coverage is being lost. Employers are dropping retiree coverage. Medicare Plus Choice plans are less available in parts of the country, particularly in rural parts of the country, such as you might have here in Wisconsin. Medigap plans coverage is not particularly good. So this is a key feature here, that these states have allowed people, even if they have other coverage, to still enroll in these plans. Most states have a mechanism by which they can increase qualifying income levels. Typically, states use this as they just adjust when the federal poverty level changes. Seven states do that. Four states actually adjust with Social Security cost of living adjustments. Two states have no indexing at all, and this can be a real problem. I'm not sure whether Tom Snedden from the PACE program talked about that in his program, but I believe in Pennsylvania that's one of the dilemmas that they have to deal with. They have people who get a boost in their Social Security check when the rates go up, and it disqualifies them from the program, and they've even come to the PACE program and said, gee, you know, I'll forego my increase in Social Security so I can still get my prescription drugs from PACE. Another key factor here, and I think this is also something that Tom might have touched on, is that three states, New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, they have about 70% of all the people enrolled in these programs in 1999. Another key thing to keep in mind here is that we found that some of the states have actually modified their eligibility criteria over time. You recall how I said how the eligibility criteria help a state control the size of the program. Some of the states realized that their programs weren't going to be as large as they thought with the initial income levels that they set, and so they raised them. Another thing that states have done is they've added tiers of programs. In the handout, you can see that, for example, Vermont and Pennsylvania are two states that have added programs, and basically they've tiered this based on income level. Next slide, please. We also found that drug coverage rules for the state pharmacy programs varied. Some states restrict coverage to specific types of drugs, such as maintenance drugs, although the definition for what is a maintenance drug can vary from state to state. Unlike private insurers, state programs do not generally use formularies that Dave talked about to limit coverage. They do, however, limit coverage in certain ways. Sometimes states define specific conditions that they will cover. Except for Illinois and Michigan, states generally do not cover drugs for which they don't get manufacturer rebates. Dave mentioned rebates being a key feature for trying to hold down costs. It's also a key feature for these programs. Michigan in particular has a limitation that they limit coverage to 3 prescriptions per month. Now, that may not necessarily be a one-month prescription for 3 different drugs, but it could be 3 prescriptions that could be a 90-day supply, so that could, it's not quite as restrictive as it might sound on its face. Next slide. Another key aspect to the states for trying to control the cost of their programs are the cost-sharing requirements that they have. Here again, you can the slide here is a little bit small for this room. Your handout has a little bit more detail on it. Cost-sharing, again, is a key factor in trying to balance program spending and beneficiary access. Beneficiary cost-sharing requirements vary among the state programs. Most of them still provide first-dollar coverage. There are a few that have annual limits or deductibles that have to be paid, have annual limits on benefits or require the enrollees to pay a deductible before they're eligible for benefits. You can see here that in some of the examples here, the deductibles vary, and there's certain reasons why each state program does that. For example, in Delaware, program enrollees would pay the greater of a $5 copay or 25% coinsurance. As Dave mentioned before me, coinsurance is another way for a program sponsor to be able to control the cost, particularly on high-priced drugs. In Illinois, after an enrollee meets the monthly deductible, the program will cover costs up to $800 annually. After that, the enrollee is going to pay 20% of each of the prescription's retail costs, and the state will pay 80%. In Maine, an enrollee can pay the greater of $2 copay or 20% coinsurance, and the coinsurance really becomes a factor if you're talking about paying for a brand name drug at a retail price as opposed to a generic. In Massachusetts, the copayment varies depending upon whether it's a generic or brand name. An interesting program that New York added was a deductible program, this is the second one listed on the chart. In that program, the deductible is a sliding scale, and it's all based on income. So again, trying to target this program based on eligibility criteria, and it also can affect cost sharing. The New York fee plan also has something that's unique here, and they have 5 different levels of copayment, with enrollees paying more as the price of the drug goes up. Next slide. Most of the state programs we examined receive some or all of their funding from state general revenue. However, there are other sources of funding that are used to pay for these benefits. These include tobacco settlement revenues, cigarette taxes, casino revenue, and a state lottery. Vermont actually receives partial funding through their Medicaid waiver with the federal government. The funding for these programs, well over 90% of the funding that these programs received in 1999 went actually to pay drug expenditures. There was only about 10% that was for administering the program. Next slide. A key feature in trying to fund these programs are manufacturer rebates. Most state programs receive rebates from manufacturers to offset program expenditures. The rebates are calculated using terms similar to the Medicaid rebate. I know there's probably some officials here that deal with that. The Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act of 1990 established a rebate for state Medicaid programs for brand name drugs. The rebate is 15% of the average manufacturer price of the drug, or the difference between the average manufacturer price and best price. Essentially, it's a 15% discount that the states receive on brand name drugs, and what these state programs that we encountered, we examined, did was essentially get the same rebate from the state Medicaid programs. Again, this is just a rebate based on volume of drugs. There are no market share incentives such as the one Dave talked about. The incentive for the manufacturers to provide rebates is that they want to get their drugs covered. and they also don't want to have them put placed on prior approval. That's why they are willing to give these rebates to these state programs. Another key reason that they're willing to give them is that the programs are not large. As I said, in 1999, they only covered 760,000 people in this country. Some of the states also get additional rebates if the price of a drug increases by more than the consumer price index. This is another feature of the Medicaid rebate law. There's only a handful of states that are actually able to get this. I believe Tom Snedden's program in Pennsylvania is one of them. And here it depends on how difficult or how tough a bargain the states are willing to try and drive with the manufacturers. I don't have it here, but there is a slide in both our report, and it may even be in the handout, I'm not sure. These rebates can represent millions of dollars for states. And they can be, for some states, a very significant portion of state funding. Next slide. Again, I apologize for the size of this, but I would refer you to a handout where I think it's a little bit more legible. One of the key decisions that states have to make here is who's going to administer their state program. By and large, states have to decide whether or not to have the program administered by the same department that administers the Medicaid program, or to have it be done by a separate agency. Many of the states do outreach to try and inform potential enrollees of their eligibility for the program. They use a variety of means to do this. They used both print, radio, television ads, and brochures. Typically, applications are handled through the mail, but most states require an annual reapplication. This was one of the aspects of these programs that we thought was particularly interesting. Michigan and Wyoming actually require a monthly reapplication. A major task that the states face in administering these programs is to determine eligibility. Again, states use two basic ways to do this. In some cases, they use their Medicaid program or the administrating state agency to do it. States request a wide variety of information, and in some cases require that applicants provide supporting documentation on their income. Most programs use a contractor to process claims. Over half of them use the same contractor that processes Medicaid claims for the state. And another key function that the states fulfill is to provide for coordination of benefits. As I mentioned, most of these programs allow people who have other coverage to enroll. And some of the states have had a particular challenge in trying to coordinate benefits with another source of coverage. They don't want to take the place of coverage that already exists. They want to supplement it. And that can be a particular challenge for some of the states. Let me just wrap up here, and I think I'm doing really good because I haven't even seen the two-minute sign yet, so I'll have more time for questions. Let me just sort of summarize the findings of our report. As I mentioned, in 1999, there were 14 states that provided access to drugs. They ran 18 different programs and covered about 760 elderly and low-income people with disabilities. Most of the programs are funded through state general revenues, although, as I mentioned, manufacturer rebates can be a key source of information or key source of funding for these states. Co-payments and co-insurance are common, and they're more common than caps on total benefits and deductibles. All of the states obtain manufacturer rebates similar to Medicaid. 9 of the 14 states administer their programs through the agency responsible for Medicaid. One of the things that I haven't mentioned that we talked a little bit in our report about was the fact that some state administrators believe that there is a problem with having the Medicaid program administer these particular drug programs, in that some people in their state perceive it as a stigma. They don't want to get they don't want to feel like they're having to go get a handout from someone. We saw this in three or four states where administrators felt that the stigma of having the Medicaid agency be the one to administer this program presented a problem in trying to encourage people to come in and take advantage of the benefit that the state had for them. As I mentioned, the three largest programs, Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, They all chose to use separate agencies to administer the program to avoid any perceived stigma that there might be of getting a handout from the state. And finally, eligibility determination, claims processing, and recovering payments, coordinating benefits with other insurers, they present some very big challenges to states in how these programs are administered. Thank you very much. I even beat the time, so we have more time for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Brandon.
Sure.
Any questions for Mr. Hansen? Yes. Over here, we have a question.
I have two. What happens to these states that you used? We get information that says there's a significant amount of free pass-outs of prescription drugs to the elderly. And when a state implements a program, is this type of program discontinued by the manufacturers?
That's a very good question. As part of the work we did for the House Commerce Committee that led to this particular study, we also did a study on drug company-sponsored patient assistance programs, again, which you can get from our website, which is gao.gov.
It's in the briefing report.
We did a very extensive study looking at how drug companies provided patient assistance programs where you could get free drugs. We did not look at whether or not those programs were more or less prevalent in states that ran state pharmacy assistance programs. That typically doesn't seem to be a factor that the drug manufacturers look at in running their particular programs. Most drug companies do have these programs. They typically require a provider, usually a physician, to be the gatekeeper on these programs. There's very little in the way of eligibility determination. It's essentially, if the physician thinks that somebody is eligible, they'll take the physician's word for it. They do require reapplications periodically. They look at it as a sort of a short-term stopgap way in which they can provide medicine to people who really need it in the absence of getting it through some other source. But generally, if you have some sort of coverage, the drug company will disqualify you from those programs. Okay.
And then just for clarification, in the pamphlet on table two, it indicates that Michigan limits coverage to 3 months per year. Is that correct or incorrect?
Yes, I think that's, let me see. It is correct, but I think those prescriptions can be for longer than a one-month prescription. There was somebody behind you.
It seems like the rebates are a way to save money. You talk about the millions of dollars being saved. What efforts are in place to make sure that the drug companies aren't just inflating their costs by 15% so there really is no savings there in the first place?
It's an excellent question. In fact, it's one that we're investigating in a study we're doing right now for the ranking minority member of the House Government Reform and Oversight Committee, Congressman Waxman from California. He was particularly concerned that drug manufacturers may not be accurately reporting the price information that is the basis for these Medicaid rebates. So it's something that we're taking a look at right now.
The inflationary price increases that have been happening are not equivalent to rebate changes, but in terms of setting the initial price, you got to bet that they're thinking about how much rebate they're going to have to give back and the wiggle room with that when they establish the price of a brand new product coming out. So when they introduce a new price, they kind of build in some buffer for that so they know, because they know that stuff's going to be coming down the pike. But on an annual year-to-year price change factor, they're not changing that much each time around. They're not moving that much different than inflation.
One of the things we do know in looking at the Medicaid rebate program over the 10 years that it's been in place is that, as I mentioned, the rebate is either the difference between the average manufacturer price and best price or 15% off of the average manufacturer price. And what we found is that over those 10 years, the gap between the average price and the best price narrowed, so where manufacturers were just giving minimum rebates. So clearly they have adjusted.
We have time for one more quick question. Representative Brisson.
I believe Maine has caps on prices, and I haven't heard any discussion yet of why more states aren't going after caps as opposed to rebates.
When we looked at Maine here, we were looking at the administration of their state program rather than their new approach. Their new approach to trying to hold down the costs. So it wasn't a subject to this particular study. I'm not sure whether Steve's going to talk about that in terms of some of the plans, what Maine's doing. I think that a lot of states are still waiting to see what's going to happen with the legal challenges by the pharmaceutical manufacturers over Maine's efforts, and I think that that's why other states have been a little reluctant to do that. The other thing here, and this also may be something that Steve touches on, there's a real difference here between programs that provide people with coverage, which is what these programs do, and other state efforts that provide people a price break. For example, California, you can go into a pharmacy and you can pay, if you're a Medicare recipient, you can get the Medicaid price that pharmacy will be reimbursed. It's not covering you for that drug, but it's giving you a price break. And I think this is one of the real challenges that states are facing, is how best to provide coverage or access to prescription drugs to the citizens. Is it by providing them a plan that will cover them, or is it by providing them access to a lower price? Because if the price difference is $80 rather than $100, there's still going to be a lot of people that aren't going to be able to afford that drug at $80.